You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 2nd. 2020, I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting multiple different kinds of steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Achin Vinayak joins us from Delhi, fellow at the Transnational Institute. He's talking with us about escalating crisis on the India-China border. What is the history behind that conflict? How does it relate to an enhanced aggressive posture in both India and China today? And what could be done to cool this conflict? Where does Pakistan fit in? Does it? All that and more. Ghislaine Maxwell has been arrested, but maybe the real story in it, well, in addition to her, is what the hell Bill Barr has been doing the last several months. That's what I would like to know about. A pool of sweat has formed around wherever Alan Dershowitz is isolated from his supposedly former friends. U.S. admits a direct role in a Lava Jato operation that made President Lula da Silva a political prisoner, paved the way for Bolsonaro, and targeted the left across Latin America. And in an incredible act of theft, a U.K. judge denies Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, access to Venezuelan gold at the Bank of England. What does he need to do in order to get the money that is his? Recognize Juan Guaido. Another 1.5 million U.S. workers file for new unemployment claims. The U.S. economy added 4.8 million jobs in June, but there are fierce headwinds coming. Speaking of workers, enormous rallies in Sao Paulo across Brazil and across Brazil yesterday of delivery workers and others working in the freelance temp economy demanding rights in the face of global Uberization. U.S. reports nearly 50,000 new coronavirus cases. That's another single-day record. And the virus rose 50% last month, led by states, led by Republican governors that opened up. Official U.S. Corona death toll is a substantial undercount of actual tally, according to a Yale study. The Trump administration, of course, thinks this is a good time to scale back the mandate that health insurers cover coronavirus tests. And are we moving towards another round of stimulus checks as Trump frets about re-election? All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Matt, Brendan, how are you guys?
Feeling the heat, but I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I would feel the same way. I'm actually doing pretty okay. It's a nice chill Thursday.
I think before, Matt, you and I need to come up with some prepared bits when Michael hands this off to us like this, because I feel like I'm off my game sometimes.
Just respond with honesty, Brendan.
Yeah, I feel like the answers are very genuine.
Usually they're
weather based.
Weather based, exactly. That's all people need.
Yeah, that's it. It's not
how's the 10 block radius in which everyone lives in the Majority Report? You don't know which. We don't share.
No.
The fireworks were outside of my place last night, actually.
What are the main fireworks conspiracy theories?
I mean, the main sort of menacing one is that it's the cops sort of like preparing people like psychologically for something worse, which I don't know. I don't super follow that. I think if cops think that they're getting one over on us by like lighting off firecrackers, I think that's probably less menacing than things they could do. But I think it's just there's a lot that were for sale, but they're not going to be sold this year because there's a pandemic. So people are selling them.
Yeah. That's pretty much what I landed on too.
I mean, there is always like, I mean, when I, a couple of times when they've seemed like they're really close, I've stepped out to try to like get eyes on people.
Yeah. I think it is just kids. People.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I don't know.
Maybe you have the streets completely empty too, because traffic is way less. So it's a lot easier to go fire those things. To be honest.
You know, traffic is way less, but do you guys feel like, I feel like in New York, things are getting quasi-normal again in a way that still feels kind of weird to me, especially when I read, you know, the numbers coming in that this pandemic is like anything but going away. It's arguably intensifying. I mean, obviously it's not as bad here as it was a month ago, but still it's just as like, I guess.
There's people grasping for it.
Yeah. There's going to be a weird tension too in the city, I feel like, with people who went away in March and are coming back now and didn't have to, you know, experience the worst of this with people who have been here the whole time. And I think it's people are going to be, you know, less than understanding for people who don't treat it with the proper caution.
Less than understanding of the people who don't treat it with the proper caution. I like that. We could put that into like a forum email. Various building associations.
Send that to Robin DiAngelo.
Well, you are out doing some ridiculous pseudoscientific HR trainings. The rest of us were on lockdown from the pandemic, damn it. I've made no secret of the fact that I think it's very important that Donald Trump be defeated. In Tuesday's interview on TMBS, Bill Fletcher Jr. and I actually talked very specifically about how some aspects of the Republican project, particularly exemplified by Mitch McConnell, Bill Barr, I would say, along with Donald Trump, but obviously Donald Trump doesn't really have any, sort of intellectual context for this, just his own sort of impulses, that basically, I'm sorry, I was a little distracted by that. I am. You need to get Donald Trump out of office. And in some ways, I mean, everybody knows Joe Biden's record, his donors. And I think few people have any illusions about what that presidency would look like. But in some ways, because we haven't had a normal campaign and I'm not subscribing to the Joe Biden podcast, it's actually been pretty easy to just sort of focus squarely in electoral context on the grotesqueness of Donald Trump, his administration, the pandemic, gassing protesters, threatening to put the military on the streets, terrorizing workers at meatpacking plants. But the Biden campaign felt a need in the past couple of days to put this ad out, and oh my God, is this ad disgusting.
No, I don't take responsibility at all.
So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please.
I just think it's a nasty question. You know you're a fake. Today I have strongly recommended that we dominate the streets. When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total.
So, I mean, it's look, the first 25 seconds of that ad is actually great in terms of what they're trying to do, which is all, again, it's just return to normal, stop the freak out, return to normal, stop the freak out, right? That's a very effective ad. But the idea that you're going to put Maduro and Castro, and who was the third person? That went by fast.
Chavez.
I mean, I will strongly defend, in many respects, Castro and Chavez. Not all respects. We can litigate, blah, blah, blah. But and of course, Maduro is under siege. I mean, Maduro is somebody that the United States has been targeted with multiple coups, right-wing forces with assassination attempts. So it's disgusting and outrageous. I mean, let's just take Castro. Fidel Castro throws out Batista and by extension, the mafia, because it's the Cuba is just like a mafia playground, right? Closes the casinos, ends prostitution, and fights against colonialism and apartheid, not only in Cuba, but actually in an incredible act of solidarity for such a small place, is sending troops to Angola and to South Africa to help in those liberation struggles. And then create literacy, healthcare, and pragmatically and systemically, you know, deal with a variety of legacy colonial issues and social divisions on the island, along with, of course, obviously, things that we could critique. But that is the Castro record. Does kicking out the mafia, fighting colonialism, and stopping casinos sound like a Donald Trump jam to you? I mean, Hugo Chavez is an army officer who rises to power on a foundation of fighting poverty in Venezuela, which he does significantly when he's president. He does cut poverty. That's, of course, gone back because of the economic warfare against Venezuela from the U.S. and others, and some mistakes in management by the Venezuelan government. So, I mean, in such a stupid time, they're not even doing the right political compass. I don't know, you know, on its face, that ad is obviously, you know, it's targeted at a Spanish-speaking audience. So in some ways, you know, it's like, you think like if you're some type of kind of like, say, like Florida hardliner, that's probably a Trump supporter. But at the same time, I do think, and this tracks with the rest of the Biden campaign, getting all this support from George W. Bush alums and everything else. I mean, that ad could be very politically effective. I would be very curious to see the polling behind that ad decision. But the idea of comparing Donald Trump to Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez, or Nicolas Maduro is embarrassing, ahistorical, absolutely disgusting, and wrong by every conceivable metric. Because I mean, even just like Trump hiking into the sea, into the mountains of Cuba, like I was the best revolutionary, I was the best, but I couldn't walk into the mountains. I mean, give me a fucking break. It is despicable. And just to underline, there's going to be no difference in foreign policy in Latin America with Biden. There's going to be absolutely no difference. These are types of things, again, just as we could say, like Biden indicating he might rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. And that was in and of itself a major and actual significant difference in 2016. That's really important. But don't be under any illusions that when it comes to Latin America, the Caribbean, there will be no structural change in U.S. foreign policy and no structural change really in the Middle East.
I mean, yeah.
With regards to, except with Iran, but I'm talking Israel, Palestine, and Saudi.
And you see that with the signaling, all the news stories that came out over the last 24 hours of a huge number of former Bush 43 officials and, you know, joining calls for Biden to be elected.
I mean, I have to say, and again, this is like what's so frustrating to me, and I'll keep reiterating, you should vote for Joe Biden to get Donald Trump out of office. But, and there are some sparks here and there. There is some strength in certain areas of the left. There is some great new energy in pockets of Congress, but that hasn't been taken to the national level yet. Bernie was the manifestation of that. That was beat back. And let's be really honest. I mean, the Biden campaign, I mean, this is like George W. Bush woke. And George W. Bush is woke now. More cautiously, just the desperate attempt to recreate the Obama era, which just isn't possible in today's world. But I do think he will win. And yeah, it's like this might be effective.
This is why I said, like, you grant the voting thing, because I think it does harm to be fantastical about voting strategy.
Absolutely.
But as far as, like, actually using your labor to help this guy win, like, no, he's made the decision, and he's been telling you from day one that he doesn't need your help. I mean, it was like, I'm left-right or leftist socialist Biden or whatever. Remember that t-shirt he put out? Like, they, and he's going to win without DSA knocking doors for him. So it's like, I think I'm just fairly happy with my, you know, vote, but no labor commitment to Biden.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And have the right analysis of it, but don't be under any delusions about it.
Exactly.
And then, you know, and then I think the fights that might take place are going to be in very specific areas. Like, I think there's some legacy labor institutions that he has support from, and it's going to be incumbent on them to fight like hell for NLRB appointments, or potentially who even the labor secretary is. But the overall context is that the left is still pretty weak. Biden will likely win. And I mean, you know, what you do is you get rid of certain extremes in human suffering, like the grotesque attack on the food stamps as an example. Potential, I mean, DACA will be codified, which is very important. I don't really know if there will be a significant change, frankly, at the border. There might be some, and that's hugely important. And then besides that, the real question is just how much does democracy itself institutionally get handcuffed even more over the next 4 years? That's really the basic dividing line question, and that relates to the future viability of a left project. Anyways, that ad's fucking disgusting. Let's, joining us, I guess we should go to him right now, is our guest. Is he here, guys?
He'll be joining us shortly.
Okay. He'll be joining us shortly, so he's not on quite yet.
Here we go.
Here we go. I can bring him in if he's
okay.
Here.
Should I just put this up?
Yes, this is great. I'll just introduce you. Yes. Thank you so much. Joining us now is, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Achin Vinayak. He's a writer and social activist, former professor at the University of Delhi, and a Delhi-based fellow at the Transnational Institute of Amsterdam. We're discussing, among other things, a recent piece of his in Jacobin, the escalating crisis on the India-China border. Achin, thank you so much for being here.
All right, pleasure to be here.
So can you give us basically just the big picture background that this border dispute between India and China goes back to at least the early 1960s, where there was previously conflict at this in this border region. Can you explain to us the origin of this border dispute and the geography of it? What part of the world specifically are we talking about?
Well, we're talking really about the part of India that is separated from Tibet. And the reason for the dispute, of course, is an issue in the sense that you have China becoming a semi-colony. India was a colony. And China eventually coming under communist rule and becoming independent in 1949. India becomes independent in 1947. But the way that India became independent is different from that of Vietnam and China, in the sense that China as a semi-colony overthrew the regimes. And Vietnam, of course, overthrew the French. In the Indian case, independence was achieved through a non-violent national liberation movement led by Gandhi, which aimed and eventually achieved a kind of transfer of power. So this transfer of power meant that India would adopt many of the policies of the former British rulers. And therefore, in a sense, it took the forward defense policy of Britain, what Britain had identified as the boundaries of British India, as its own boundaries. What this meant was that there wasn't really a willingness on the Indian part to do more of a give and take with countries like China and others. Of course, one should also recognize that we're talking about Tibet, and the Chinese, of course, took over Tibet. So they can have justifiable criticisms of the Chinese on Tibet, and you can have justifiable criticisms of India, which didn't allow, for example, the Northeast Nagaland to become independent and so on. But insofar as India accepted the suzerainty of China over Tibet, there should have been a give and take. And in fact, in 1960, there was an offer from Chiang Kai-shek for saying that, look, we need this part, which is bordering Tibet, and the other part of India, which is bordering the east, is not really that much concern to us. So why don't we have give and take on these lines? India refused. And then war erupted in 1962. India was defeated. And since then, there has been this burning sore in the Indian mentality among all the governments there. So that's really the background, and the opportunities to resolve it were there in 1960. They were there in 1980, in the late 1980s. They were not taken. And then, of course, you have the situation where the 90s onward, you have India having a closer and closer relationship with the United States. And, of course, you have the U.S.-China relationship, which has had increasing problems.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Can you elaborate?
I was going to say, go ahead. Go ahead. Please,
no,
go
please.
Ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Can you elaborate on the strategic, why would India, particularly in the 80s, I guess, and maybe you could explain a little bit more about this taking on of the reason that India would replicate, British colonial policies with regards to its stance on borders. But beyond that, is this a question of sort of like national pride or prestige, or is there important material resources and strategic stakes of this positioning? Like, as an example, does the Chinese occupation of Tibet offer access to water or minerals or timber? Does it give them an advantage with regard to any conflict with India? How much of these sort of claims are, what are the strategic stakes of these claims, basically?
From the Chinese point of view, and even from the Indian point of view, it's basically political. It's not as if there are tremendous resources there, and that's why they're trying to grab it. In the Chinese case, of course, the political strategic importance is the question of Tibet and Xinjiang. And since the Chinese are now building what's called the Belt Road Initiative, there is a connection to Pakistan and the establishment of what is called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. I mean, you've heard of the Belt Road Initiative, which is a huge development in which India, China, in order to address its economic needs, overcapacity and so on, is trying to make a kind of road and rail and infrastructure link all the way through Pakistan, and whereby it can connect on the road, on land, it can connect with Europe, and right up to the east, it can connect with Japan and also the maritime system and so on. So what's happening is that what India is doing along its border, the Chinese see as threatening its control over Xinjiang and Tibet, and threatening the connection between China, Xinjiang, Tibet, and Pakistan, especially since it's going through a part of a region that at the moment belongs to Pakistan, but which India claims, because this is a leftover legacy of the partition between India and Pakistan, in which what was called the province of Jammu and Kashmir got divided, with part of it on the Pakistani side and the other part on the Indian side. So that's the material factor here. There are also other aspects in the sense that the Chinese also want to send a message to the Indians that, look, why are you part? And we are getting extremely worried because you're part of the American design to contain us. And that, of course, is also a reality because India, since the 1990s, has become ever closer to the United States in strategic terms. So
you talk about that relationship.
India sees China.
Can you talk about, I'm sorry, I think there's a delay between us. I apologize. But can you just elaborate on the history of the Chinese, of the U.S. Indian alliance, and how that change started to happen in the 90s, and particularly with regards to tensions between the United States and China.
Okay. Well, before the India-China War of 1962, the Americans were not happy with India because India had a kind of non-aligned policy, which basically meant that it wouldn't align with the West and it wouldn't align with the East and the Soviet Union and would like good relations with both. Mm-hmm. In the American case, ever since the formation of the Soviet Union after the Second World War, it wanted to build an alliance structure that would contain the Soviet Union and China, which became communist also. And therefore, the United States had very good military alliances with Pakistan. So given the India-Pakistan relationship, you had the Indians staying aloof from the Americans. The Indian non-aligned policy was not towards, was not favored by the United States. Over a period of time, after the India-China conflict, there was the potential for India and the U.S. to come closer together. And to some extent, they did. Mm-hmm. But then you also had 1971, the Bangladesh conflict, and the partition of Pakistan. And Pakistan was an ally of the United States. And the United States supported Pakistan and opposed the formation of Bangladesh. So that became an area of tension. You also had the Sino-Soviet conflict. And in the late 60s, 1971, after Kissinger's trip to Beijing, you had the U.S.-China Entente against the Soviet Union. Huh? And so you had all of these kind of situation here. So you have opposition on the strategic sense, in the sense that the Indians were unhappy about American support to China and to Pakistan. Hmm? Both were seen as enemies of India. Hmm? Over a period of time, in the 80s, there is improvement in the relations between India and the United States. Things change after the end of the Cold War. You have the Sino-Soviet conflict ending, right? You have India, which opens its economy, wanting to move closer to the United States. And if you like, you have a kind of triangle with India and Pakistan at two ends, two corners of this triangle, and the United States at the apex. And India saying to the United States, look, come closer to us. Why are you close to Pakistan? And Pakistan saying to the United States, remain close to us, come closer, don't get close to. And the United States saying to both of them in the 90s and thereafter, listen, you are both my spouses. I like you both. You, India, are number one spouse because you're bigger and more important. But you, Pakistan, are also number two spouse. And I'm not going to abandon either of you because I need both of you for different reasons. You, the Indians, I need for geopolitically southwards and eastwards to contain China. You, Pakistan, I need you westwards and northwards to help us vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. And I need you, Pakistan, for our geostrategic purposes vis-a-vis the North, Central Asia, Afghanistan, elsewhere. So this has been the kind of triangle in which India and Pakistan don't move closer together, but are preoccupied with their relationship with the United States. In the case of the other triangle, if you like, between China, India, and the United States, let's understand that China and Russia are basically reactive powers to the United States. That is to say, China, after it started move towards capitalism, wanted to develop, doesn't want the United States to see it as an enemy. It wants time to be able to develop and modernize and become a greater and greater power. And after the end of the Cold War, the United States foreign policy establishment, what was its attitude towards China? Its attitude towards China was that, look, China is potentially a strategic rival and a strategic opponent. But given the closer economic relationships between the two us, there were also sections within the American establishment that were saying, well, you know, China is also potential not a rival or an opponent. And therefore, the United States quite cleverly made preparations on both levels. It made preparations to treat the Chinese as a potential opponent and rival, and also made preparations not to treat it as such. What's happened over time with Obama's pivot to Asia and now with Trump is that the American establishment has decided China is a strategic opponent. And India being part of the containment of China, that also riles China. And India seeing China as its strategic opponent also has this problem. So you have a real downturn, a serious problem in the relations between the two. I'm sorry.
No, it's great.
I've gone on for some time.
Oh, this is perfect. This is why we wanted to interview. Can you then give us actually the same trajectory, but between Pakistan and China?
Well, in the case of Pakistan and China, for a long time, the Pakistans had all their eggs, strategic eggs, in the American basket. After all, they were an ally in the 50s and in the 60s and so on, right? In the 1965 war, the United States of America said that we're not, sorry, the 1965 war between India and Pakistan, okay? In the 1965 war between India and Pakistan, the Pakistanis got a big shock because the Americans said, we are not going to supply arms to either side. Why did this shock the Pakistanis? Pakistanis said, we have a military alliance with you. We are an ally. When we are in a situation where we need your support and arm, you're now saying that even though we're an ally, you're not giving us arms. So they began to think that they should also be more flexible and they should take advantage of the India-China bad relations because of the India-China war. So the Pakistanis explore a relationship with the Chinese. So you begin to see a situation in which, as I said, you have that triangle between the United States, Pakistan, and India. You have developments in the 70s in which the American relationship with Pakistan fluctuates, 65, and then in 71, it's a closer relationship, right, and to the 70s also. And then in the 80s, things begin to change. As you have developments that take place after the end of the Cold War and especially after 2001 and the assault on New York and Washington, the terrorist attack, you begin to see the Americans being very much concerned about the Middle East and also how to contain, move towards some degree of containment of Russia and so on, and then its involvement in Afghanistan, the need for Pakistan there, and all sorts of, if you like, combinations that then become important to it, and how it has to deal with all of these kinds of combinations and relationships with these different countries. It needs Pakistan because of Afghanistan. It needs India because of China. How should it balance between the two?
In the situation today, Let's get to what happened a couple of weeks ago and where we are now. But before we elaborate on that, let's take the personalities of Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi. And I guess I'm curious because there is this sort of top level analysis, and I think there's some truth to it, but it might not be a specific enough truth to tell us much. So there is this trend of these more sort of right-wing, nationalistic leaders. We could see it, you know, the usual list that people mention. There's elements of this, obviously, with Trump, with Bolsonaro, with Netanyahu, Putin, and then Modi and Xi Jinping are put on that list as well. And I think in both cases, for justifiable reasons. But I guess what I'm curious about, because even with some of the sort of, you know, very significant attention-grabbing things like the extreme aggression and abuse of the Kashmiris that's taking place right now, we can situate, just like we've situated this conversation in decades-long policy, including, you said, in two different points, 1960 and in the late 1980s, both under Congress Party leadership, where this had the potential to actually be resolved. So I guess how much of what we're seeing right now is just the kind of inevitable trajectory of policy that's been set in place for decades that hasn't been resolved versus the heightened aggression and potential recklessness of two leaders potentially striking in a more aggressive direction?
Well, one thing is that I would say that both in the case of Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi, you're talking about an escalation of an aggressive, belligerent nationalism domestically, which will have its expression to some extent even in foreign policy matters. In the Indian case, the Modi regime has always blamed the Congress Party for the failure to maintain its territory and control. And its aggressive belligerentism expresses itself in saying that we are going to make a strong India, we're going to teach Pakistan a lesson, we're going to become an imperial power, which is also going to challenge China, and we should reclaim the territories that have been lost to Pakistan, and even the territories that we should at least, whether we lost to China. This is, in fact, a rhetoric which is much more forcefully expressed. None of this helps to improve relations or do a settlement with China. In the case of the Chinese, their reaction is that, okay, the border issue is we have got what we wanted. We could come to some agreement with the Indians. But they're getting more and more worried about the fact that the United States is becoming much, much more aggressive towards it. And the Indians are going along with it. And therefore, they also feel the need to also assert themselves. And there's also that economic dimension of the Belt Road Initiative. There's also the fact that it is an authoritarian state. And how does it gather support from its own domestic population? Certainly not on the basis of communism. It's not a communist society. It's an increasingly unequal society. It also has to be much more aggressively nationalist. Look, we're going to be a strong power. We must stand up to the United States and so on. That would be one picture. I'm tempted to make a distinction between the United States and China, which may be of interest, although it's a bit peripheral to the India-China issue.
Please, go ahead.
And that is that the United States is, if you like, the United States is, because it's an internal democracy, no matter how weak, no matter how fading, but obviously so, the United States government is always more cautious domestically, internally. The Chinese are more cautious externally and extremely aggressive internally. So look at what they're doing with Hong Kong. Look at what they're doing in Xinjiang. Look what they've done in Tibet. Huh? The American government, for all its brutalities, has to be more cautious because of the federal character of the United States. And I think this is something that's very important to understand. American foreign policy represents a much more serious and grave threat to the world order. Yes. The Russians and the Chinese are pretty bad, but they're also reactive to it. And one clear example of where this reaction is taking place is this whole question of the nuclearization of outer space, which incidentally has its knock-on effects on India and Pakistan. The Americans have decided to nuclearize, militarize outer space, building the ballistic missile defense shield. The Chinese and the Russians are saying we have to overburden the defense shield by building more and more and bigger bombs and more delivery systems. The Indians are saying, look, the Chinese are doing this because of the Americans, but they could turn their bombs against us, so we have to build more and more nuclear bombs. And the Pakistanis are saying, look, the Indians are doing this, and they're saying they have to do it because... So you have, from an American initiative, an escalating nuclear arms race, both in East Asia and in South Asia, which is very worrying.
Yeah, absolutely. What is the relationship between India's the belligerent nationalism of Modi and the fact that it is sort of increasingly, you know, China is its own distinct power, and it's a reactive power. But India
reactive
is reactive to the United States. But India is sort of on one hand, kind of asserting this ultra nationalism, this Hindutva vision, but also essentially just folding deeper and deeper into U.S. security interests. How is that sort of message balanced in India? And I mean, is it like in Israel? Is Trump quite popular on the right in India? I know he and Modi have a fairly close relationship. Modi seems to know how to play Trump pretty well. But how does that dynamic work out in terms of the nationalist messaging in India?
Okay. Well, first, let me say, I said Chinese in the United States, but that should not be allowed to, that should not dismiss the fact that the Chinese also behave in their own aggressive manner, independent of the United States. Yes. It's overall in the strategic sense. So I don't want to let the Chinese off the hook in any way, nor the Russians. Yes. In the case of India and USA, again, the United States sets the terms. The Indians would like to come closer, but there's that damn problem about the American relationship with Pakistan, which also makes it, and the Indians realize this. So how do they get closer to the Americans if the Americans are still going to play a game with the Pakistanis? And this is where the non-substitutable benefits that the United States gets from Pakistan and India means that you can't have a wholehearted embrace. But to the extent that India sees China as its biggest strategic rival, then it's getting closer and closer relations with the Americans. But that doesn't mean that the Americans will do what the Indians want them to do from time to time. So within the Indian establishment, you have those who say, we must move closer and closer to the Americans. And then you have others who say, well, look, to what extent are the Americans going to help us? We should pursue our own national interests, and we should be more careful about the United States, and so on. Huh? A very small element, which is almost negligible, is the one which is hostile to American imperialism and says that you should move away from being part of the Quad and you should be more independent and so on. The dominant attitude in India is that India is a country which should be seen as a major global power. And just as China is seen as a dominant force in East Asia, why aren't we seen as a dominant force in South Asia? And the reason why we can't be seen as a dominant force in South Asia is because the Pakistanis are there. We don't have the same dominance, if you like, as that. So that's a constant irritation, a constant problem, that even in South Asia, where in terms of size, in terms of population, in terms of overall economic strength, but not in terms of military strength, huh? It doesn't dominate in the way that the Chinese are dominant over all their neighbors, of course, barring Russia, of course, in Eurasia. Huh? So you don't have the same sense. And you also don't have the same sense to the frustration of Modi and others and to all the others. India is not seen as, it's seen as an emerging power. But as a world power, as a potential world player, no, it's not that, and it's still very far from that. As for the question of Israel, there's a difference. Israel has a much closer relationship to the United States, to the extent that many in the United States say that it's the Israeli tail that wags the American dog. You can't say that about the India-US relationship. Mm-hmm. And even though I don't believe that the Israeli tail wags the American dog, the American relationship to Israel is unfortunately a very deep one. Hmm? Not an India-U.S. relationship is not at all comparable.
Absolutely.
Not to the U.S.
Right, right. I mean, the history of the Israeli relationship goes...
And incidentally, there's another dimension. Israel's positioning in the Middle East is much more important than South Asia. From a geopolitical as well as from oil, gas, and its connection to Central Asia and the Middle East as a whole, the MENA region, Middle East, North African region, is geopolitically much more important than South Asia. And the role that India can play in South Asia for the United States is not as important as the role Israel can play in the MENA region, where it's, of course, the dominant force. So geopolitically is important for the longer term thinking. Yeah.
So take us then. Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, we had this clash. I believe 20 troops was the assessment that I read in terms of Indian troops that died. I didn't know how many casualties there were on the Chinese side. This gripped everybody's attention, and the news cycle being as it is, it sort of went away, at least internationally, after about a day or two of concern. But this is obviously, you know, this is a very tense situation in a very tense part of the world. So where are we now, a couple of weeks out? What have the responses been from India and China respectively? And where are we now, and what is the state of play, and what might come next?
Well, what seems to have happened is that the Chinese are taking control of certain areas which they did not have control of before, right? So that would seem to be the case, one. Well, I say seem to be the case because you have a lot of secrecy surrounding what's happening on the Chinese very obvious side, very obviously, but even on the Indian side, there's been careful not to, one doesn't get a very clear picture. But what we can see from satellite images and all is that the Chinese have some control over in the Galwan Valley area and in another area called Pangkok Su Lake, that area. They seem to have some control over there, material ground control. At the same time, discussions between the military, top military brass on both sides, has led to an agreement that we should disengage our troops some 2 kilometers. Each of us go back 2 kilometers from where there's been tension. Huh? But that's it for the moment. Huh? Neither side would like is escalation. But since the border is unclarified, there are tensions. And you have a border situation in which the Chinese are stronger in certain areas, and the Indians are stronger in other areas. And there's also a pressure on the Indian side to assert itself on the areas where it is stronger, if you like. So there is that temptation. Two things. This is even this hiatus, even this stoppage of tensions escalating and coming down to a certain extent, is not going to be resolved at the military level. It will have to be done at the political, diplomatic level. That is one. Second is that the best that we can hope for is that there will be a de-escalation and there will be an uneasy relationship existing for some very considerable time. There is always the potential for some local development that nobody is in control of that can take place and then create a spark, precisely because there are overlaps in that area of what each side thinks belongs to them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, given the larger geostrategic situation, I don't see any serious move towards a resolution of the border issue between India and China. I think it's going to be a tension-filled situation in which there is now much greater distrust on either side. And the likelihood is that there will be a hardening of relations and that the Indians will want to move even closer, not only to the United States, but there's a lot of talk about India also expressing its support for Taiwan, being more critical of what the Chinese are doing in Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and so on. And all of these will also create certain tensions. And then the Chinese will want to improve their relations with Pakistan. And that will also have its effect on India. And I've already told you about the nuclear issue and those tensions. So, and of course, what India is now doing and what Modi is now doing is talking about restricting China's economic entry into India. And it's already talked about saying that we are not going to allow the Chinese to invest, Chinese investors in. They're not to be investors in building roads. They're not to come in as investors in what are called the micro, small, and medium manufacturing industries or service industries. India is not talking about boycotting all Chinese goods because it needs a lot of Chinese electronic and also a lot of Chinese raw materials for its pharmaceuticals and so on. But there's also going to be a sort of payback on the economic side. So generally speaking, at the economic level, at the political, at the diplomatic, and at the military level, the prospects are that as compared to what the situation was before, it's going to get worse.
Final question for you. I know it's going to be very difficult to measure, maybe even impossible, debates inside the sort of Chinese diplomatic community, although obviously there are, but they're, you know, not as transparent. But to the extent you could gauge, I mean, it, certainly in India, is the Congress Party, is main opposition parties essentially on board for this hawkish posture of the Modi government? Or is there criticisms inside the context of domestic politics? And I mean, I'm actually curious if this applies to, you know, sort of questions of Muslim citizenship, the assault on Kashmir. Is there any, I know that there is a strong left in India, you know, not a majority, obviously, but they make their voices heard, have some presence, particularly on different state levels. But is there any national level response? If I interviewed Shashi Tharoor or somebody like that, would I potentially hear something different about the Indian posture on these issues than what's coming from the Modi government?
The difference between the Congress and the Modi government on this, on what has happened now, is very much on the same plane of nationalism. They're criticizing the Modi government for being weak. And they're criticizing the Modi government for being secretive. We don't know exactly what's happening on the border, because Modi made a statement which was quite ridiculous when he said that the Chinese have not been able to enter into Indian territory. And then this was refined by the Ministry of External Affairs to say that the Chinese did come in, but they've been pushed back. And it's quite clear that from many sources that that's not the case. So they're criticizing Modi for being secretive, and they're criticizing Modi for failing. In other words, not being aggressive enough. So this is not a move, if you like, to be less jingoistic, but sharing the same platform. Yeah. In the case of the left, on the Muslim issue, on the question of, for example, the citizenship, the Congress has got some criticism of it, but not a very serious or strong criticism of the Modi. It says, okay, we want to maintain our Muslim support, but Modi is gaining ground among Hindus, and we must play the Hindu card. And more the Congress is playing the Hindu card, right? In the case of the left is critical of Modi's anti-Muslim policies. But when it comes to the China policy and the question of nationalism, unfortunately, the left does not stand out as a serious critique, or very different from the Congress Party or others. The left comes from a tradition which should have recognized the relevance of what Lenin said with regard to the question of the right to self-determination and the question of nationalism. What has the left said with regard to Kashmir? They're not going to support the idea that the Kashmiri people in the valley, particularly, which is the most oppressed part, should have the right to self-determination. No, no, no. But they will say, we would like to restore the earlier degree of autonomy which they had, which had already been eroded by the Congress Party to a great extent. The Congress Party says, well, you have eliminated that autonomy. We are not saying that you should restore that autonomy, but we don't like the unconstitutional manner in which you took away that autonomy. In other words, we don't like the manner, even though we don't dispute the outcome. And almost all the other opposition parties go along with that. So even on this case of the India-China issue, you don't really have a serious criticism of India's foreign policy from the left. And part of the reason is because the Indians never had a very serious criticism of India's non-aligned policy, which is better than what it is now. But it has never really come to terms with the hypocrisies of Indian foreign policy since 1947. And of course, in China, who is prepared to criticize the hypocrisies of the Chinese foreign policy? Right. Or in Russia, who's prepared to do that? But at least you can say that China is an authoritarian, non-democratic country. One would have hoped that within India, there would be much more courageous criticism of Indian foreign policies and a much stronger willingness to attack the deceits and hypocrisies of the Indian government and its external behavior. And I can give you an account of so many things, etc. here. But then the same problem probably in the United States of America. No?
You sound that the parallels are the Democrats are, yes, that's almost entirely it. The Democratic response is either to try to outflank or, yeah, criticize means, not ends. Or, you know, in some cases, whenever Trump completely dishonestly or sort of randomly questions some sort of militaristic component of U.S. foreign policy, which, of course, he'll end up doubling down on anyways. He's been an extraordinarily aggressive and militaristic president. And as you noted, even with the weaponization of space and skyrocketing civilian casualties across the globe. But occasionally, if he says something, you know, I mean, just even the last couple of days, you know, we need to get out of Afghanistan. Well, the Democrats in the House are working to make sure that that doesn't happen. So, yeah, very, 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 very similar dynamic. I really appreciate your time, Achin Vinayak. Please read all of Achin's pieces in Jacobin to understand this situation, understand the Modi government, all of the dynamics in India, China, Pakistan, as well as the, of course, unfortunate and problem-causing role of the United States. Achin, thank you so much for doing this. Appreciate it.
Brendan, can I give one plug, Brendan, before you finish? Can I give one plug for a book that I've written, which has just come out?
About the
Modi government, about nationalism. I came out with a book before, which came out in March, called Nationalist Dangers, Secular Failings, a compass for an Indian left. So Nationalist Dangers, Secular Failings. It's a book which is available by Flipkart or Amazon. And it's an analysis of the Modi government's aggressive nationalism, Hindutva nationalism, and the expansion that it has had in terms of its hegemonic influence in India. So that would be something that could give an insight into what's been happening in the Indian context.
Say the name one more time.
Nationalist Dangers, Secular Failings.
Great.
A compass for an Indian left. And so it's available with Amazon or Flipkart.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time. We'll read the book.
Thank you.
Take care. All right, folks.
Okay.
Working on it.
Yeah, okay, it looks like, I think, I don't know.
We could just pin Michael's video, too.
It's fine. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show keeps chugging along. Check out the Majority Report merch, including the masks. All the proceeds go, the Northwest Immigration Rights Center, I believe. Hope that's the name of it. On Tuesday's TMBS, we had a great in-depth conversation with Bill Fletcher Jr. I hit on a bunch of topics you'll want to hear my view on in the post-game, including this trash right fragility book, weighed in on the right-wing populism debate, and we also talked about when Fidel Castro visited Harlem in 1995 and touched a bit on when he visited in 1960. And the conversation with Bill Fletcher Jr. on a anti-repression movement reviving labor and the stakes of 2020 through a democracy in chains lens, as well as why we need to put all of our energy into saving the post office. Go to patreon.com/TMBS. Last Sunday, illicit history of how we get to proper and full trans equity with Joanna Vist and cultural politics of corporate America, the Supreme Court and capital, and how all of these issues are linked. Patreon.com/TMBS to get the whole thing. TMBS.fm. The store is restacked. Pre-sales for your dope American and union-made gear, like the Sankara t-shirt, the No Coup t-shirt's really fun. Snag your merch and go to Red Emma's to buy a copy of Against the Web, Cosmopolitan Answers, New Right. I dare say so myself, the thesis of that book and that cosmopolitan socialist synthesis is more important than ever as the unfortunate sort of culture war politics reamps up. There was a decent review of it in Unheard yesterday. And of course, you can subscribe to Michael Brooks Show on YouTube and iTunes. Matt, Literary Hangover, what's cooking?
Yeah, well, twitch.tv/literary hangover, a lot of good stuff going on there. And the podcast will return. Members will get the third part of my Orwell Line in the Unicorn read through with Alex and Grace. And for public freebie listeners, they'll be getting the first two parts of that this Saturday.
Sweet. Jamie's here. What's cooking, Jamie?
Hello. I have three things to plug today. First thing, this week on the Antifada, we spoke with Nick Estes of the podcast Red Nation about his book on Standing Rock, taking down all the racist statues, the connection between the fight for indigenous rights and the uprising for Black lives, and how to envision decolonization. That's out now for free for everyone. Highly recommend it. He's so smart and great. It's awesome. Also, tomorrow, my caucus, my DSA caucus, Emerge, is putting on a teach-in with Mike Davis, great Marxist historian, on the rebellion for Black lives, the history of urban resistance, and the future of the U.S. left. That's at 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. I'll put a link to that in the blog. And then on Saturday, the Socialism Conference, Socialism 2020, is happening virtually. And I'm going to be on a panel called Socialist Organization and the Capitalist State at 2:30 p.m. with Eric Blanc. And it's going to be like a bit of a Socratic dialogue, I think, because we have things we agree on and we have things we disagree on. So check that out. I'm going to put a link to everything in the blog.
Cool. All right, folks. Check out the Nomiki show as well, of course. And we will see you in the on the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.